families of the hostages held by Hamas are demanding that the Israeli government do more to free their loved ones.
Hostage families have started a march from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem to protest what they say is government not doing enough to help get their loved ones out.
Plus, supporters of Israel rallied by the tens of thousands on Washington's National Mall.
The timing with respect to calling for releasing the hostages is quite fortuitous.
And leaders from the 21-member Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Group are gathering in San Francisco to talk about how to better spur trade and economic growth across the Pacific region. Today is Wednesday, November 15th, and this is VOA's International Edition. The Israeli military says its forces have entered Gaza's Shifa Hospital, the site of a lengthy standoff. The army has surrounded the facility as part of its ground offensive against Hamas. Israeli authorities claim the militant group conceals military operations in the facility, but with hundreds of patients and medical personnel inside, it has refrained from entering. Early Wednesday, the army said its forces were carrying out a precise and targeted operation against Hamas in a specified area of the hospital. It gave no further details, but said it was taking steps to avoid harm to civilians. This is a developing story, and VOAnews.com will have updates as we receive them. Along with dire conditions at Gaza's Shifa Hospital, the families of hostages held by Hamas marched to demand the Israeli government do more to free their loved ones. I spoke with Middle East correspondent Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem about these and other recent developments in the Israel-Hamas war.
Well, it's not exactly clear what's going on there. Israel says that it offered help to get the premature babies out of the hospital. The hospital has basically shut down. It darkened. There are still patients and doctors there. And Israel said that its help was denied. They said that Palestinians can still leave the hospital and other areas on a safe corridor from the Shifa Hospital down south, and in the past 10 days, 200,000 Palestinians have left. Israel also says that Hamas is using the hospitals as human shields and has built bunkers underneath the hospital. They showed video footage from a nearby hospital, the Rantisi Hospital for Children, in which there was a tunnel underneath the hospital that led to a room, that led to, first of all, weapons, and then a room where they believe that at one point the hostages were kept. At the same time, there's no fuel. There's no food in northern Gaza, and the situation is getting quite desperate.
Linda, can you describe the military action taking place close to the hospital?
Yes. Well, Israeli troops have now taken over the Shati refugee camp, which is relatively close to the hospital. They are at the gates of the hospital, surrounding the hospital, but they have not gone into the hospital itself. And they are trying, they said, to get as many people out of the hospital as they can. But there's, of course, been heavy fighting in that entire area. And basically all of northern Gaza, huge parts of it have been destroyed. I mean, it's going to take many, many years to rebuild and be the top of the agenda.
Linda, finally, we've been hearing a lot about possible negotiations for hostage release. What have you heard?
So, first of all, the hostage families have started a march from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, a five-day march, to protest what they say is government not doing enough to help get their loved ones out. You're talking now, I mean, the numbers keep changing because, for example, two of the people who were thought to be taken hostage, a 12-year-old girl and an older Canadian Israeli peace activist, were now found dead. So it's apparently their remains were somewhere between the Israeli border and just over the Gaza border and were found as the soldiers got there. So the numbers keep changing, but we're talking about 238 hostages. Hamas has offered a deal in which up to 70 Israeli hostages would be released in exchange for several dozen Palestinian women and children who are in Israeli jails, having been convicted of crimes, and a five-day ceasefire. And apparently those negotiations are moving ahead and are relatively close to fruition. But again, we've heard this before. There have been rumors of deals. Tomorrow will be 40 days. There are babies who were in captivity and taken hostage without their mothers. There are young children. So I think this sense is growing. growing in Israel that time is running out. And I think most Israelis would support this kind of partial deal. The government worries that a five-day ceasefire would, first of all, give Hamas time to rearm. And secondly, after 5 days, there will be increasing pressure on Israel to extend the ceasefire. And Israel says that it has not yet defeated Hamas as a military power, which is what its goal in this war is.
The United States is backing Israeli claims that Hamas, a U.S.-designated terror group, is using hospitals in Gaza for cover to direct its military operations and hold hostages. VOA National Security Correspondent Jeff Seldon has more.
Israel's no longer alone in accusing Hamas and its allies of hiding behind hospitals in Gaza.
We do have information that Hamas and the Palestinian Islamic Jihad uses some hospitals in the Gaza Strip, including the Al-Shifa Hospital, as a way to conceal and support their military operations and hold hostages.
Pentagon spokesperson Sabrina Singh echoing comments from the White House, saying the two groups also operate a command and control node under Al-Shifa.
They have weapons stored there and are prepared to respond to an Israeli military operation against the facility.
Both the Pentagon and the White House say the newly declassified intelligence was collected by the U.S., though they refuse to say how. The U.S. intelligence comes just a day after the Israel Defense Forces issued a video showing what it says is under Gaza's Rantisi Hospital.
A hideout where terrorists take hostages and hide out.
At the Israeli embassy in Washington, Deputy Chief of Mission Eliav Benjamin tells VOA,
"We are releasing as much as we can."
Benjamin says there is evidence innocent civilians are trying to leave and that Israel will give them as much time as it can. But
at the end of the day, Israel will take action against these terrorists.
The Pentagon's Sabrina Singh says the U.S. is still urging caution.
Absolutely. We do not want to see a firefight in a hospital where there are innocent civilians.
Jeff Seldon, VOA News, Washington.
Attacks from Iranian-backed militants have not let up, with a multi-rocket attack coming within a half kilometer of mission support site Euphrates in eastern Syria on Tuesday. The U.S. says deterrence is working with Iran, but is it enough to stop the barrage of drones and rockets? VOA's Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb has details.
This video shows the latest U.S. attack against a training facility used by Iran's military and its proxies in eastern Syria. U.S. fighter jets struck the training center and this safe house Sunday in response to attacks on U.S. forces. Defense officials tell VOA Iranian-backed militants have attacked U.S. troops in Iraq and Syria at least 56 times in less than a month, with at least five attacks coming after the Sunday strikes. Pentagon Deputy Press Secretary Sabrina Singh.
Is deterrence working? We feel that it is. We have not seen this war spread into a wider regional conflict. The strikes that we are taking is to signal and to message very strongly to Iran and their affiliated groups to stop. That is the purpose of those strikes.
Getting the message, because they keep striking.
I understand that. But again, I think we are being very deliberate on how when we conduct our strikes against these groups, and I think that Iran is certainly seeing that message.
More than 50 Americans suffered minor injuries or traumatic brain injuries from the attacks before returning to duty, officials say. A bipartisan group of senators telling reporters Tuesday the U.S. is lucky that no Americans have died from the attacks and calling for a stronger response against Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, or IRGC. Senator Lindsey Graham.
If Iran continues to threaten our troops in Syria and Iraq, the right response militarily would be, in my view, to hit the IRGC training bases and infrastructure inside of Iran.
They have never doubted our capabilities. On occasion, they have doubted our will.
Retired General Frank McKenzie, the former commander of U.S. forces in the Middle East, tells VOA the message America sent by its reduction of forces in the region has left Iran emboldened.
Their primary goal remains the ejection of the United States from the region, and that's the reason these attacks are spiking up.
And two defense officials now confirming to VOA that the U.S. was indeed very lucky during an attack last month at Erbil Air Base. A drone crashed into barracks housing U.S. troops. It failed to detonate, but one official told me had the drone exploded, several troops could have been injured or killed. Carla Babb, VOA News, the Pentagon.
Tens of thousands of demonstrators gathered on the National Mall in Washington Tuesday for the March for Israel event. For more insight, VOA's Kim Lewis spoke with Ellen Lapson, director of the Masters in International Security degree program and the Center for Security Policy Studies at George Mason University.
I think those are three very big goals. To some extent, the timing with respect to calling for releasing the hostages is quite fortuitous, because it does seem that in the last 24 hours, there's been a lot of progress being publicly acknowledged, and we may be seeing the release of at least the women and children fairly soon. That is the over 100, possibly over 200 hostages being held by Hamas since October 7th. If the larger picture that you're referring to is whether this war will, you know, turn into something more on the diplomatic side for the region, I think it's still quite early to tell. I think the Israelis will probably not be receptive to any big new diplomatic initiative to get deeper into solving the long-standing, you know, rivalry and competition for the land between Israelis and Palestinians until they've achieved their military objectives. And I think while they may be perhaps able to update the world on what they have done to dismantle Hamas's military capabilities, they have not really indicated any timeline for when their military operations might be able to scale down.
Also, in looking at this demonstration, can it be seen as a message of unity?
So I think the organizers across the country and Jewish communities and Jewish federations, which are civil society organizations, was exactly that, to demonstrate, you know, across different political preferences, across different forms of Judaic observances, from, you know, secular and reform and conservative and orthodox, that this was intended to demonstrate a unity of purpose. I think the organizers have had to, you know, be very careful in what the speakers are saying and what the messages are. But it looks, at least from the videos so far, it looks like it was largely a very positive event, and it may have achieved the objectives of the organizers. So, you know, the American Jewish community is very diverse politically and in terms of cultural styles, et cetera. But this unity of purpose to show support for Israel after a truly horrific attack, I don't know whether it also means support for, you know, all of the tactical choices the Israeli national security establishment has made, that perhaps people would have a range of opinion about that. You know, certainly also a concern about diaspora Jews facing a very startling spike in anti-Semitic activity, both in the U.S. and certainly we're seeing it in Europe as well.
That was Ellen Lapson, director of the Masters in International Security degree program and the Center for Security Policy Studies at George Mason University, speaking with my colleague, Kim Lewis. We're following these other stories from around the world. The U.S. State Department says it has no intentions of easing sanctions or normalizing relations with de facto Taliban authorities in Afghanistan until the Islamist regime improves the grim human rights situation in the country. The use of anti-personnel landmines by Russia and Myanmar triggered a surge in the number of civilian casualties in Ukraine and Myanmar last year. That's according to a new report by the International Campaign to Ban Landmines. Mali's army said Tuesday it has retaken the northern city of Kidal from rebels after a raid that left many insurgents dead. The reported capture, not confirmed by independent observers, would mark a symbolic victory for Mali's army. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Rick Pantaleo. The United States is hosting the annual APEC Summit of World Leaders this week. Leaders from the 21-member Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Group are gathering in San Francisco to talk about how to better spur trade and economic growth across the Pacific region. VOA's Lori London reports.
The main summit event will be on the sidelines, where President Joe Biden and Chinese President Xi Jinping are expected to have a face-to-face meeting Wednesday. But White House National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan says while the Biden summit with China's leader may get all the attention,
President Biden will be doing a lot more than just meeting with President Xi. He'll be welcoming leaders from across the Asia-Pacific for APEC Economic Leaders Week at a moment when the most dynamic economic region in the world is looking to the United States as the leading economy in the world.
Still, Biden and Xi's anticipated meeting are of great importance as the leaders of the world's two biggest economies try to find a measure of stability after what's been a difficult year for U.S.-China relations. Lori London, VOA News, Washington.
More than 20,000 people were expected to gather this week in San Francisco, where leaders of 21 economies in the Asia-Pacific are meeting. Activists also see the meeting as an opportunity to have their voices heard. VOA's Elizabeth Lee, along with reporters from VOA's East Asia and Pacific Division, have this story from San Francisco.
Protesters are pounding the pavement.
What do we want?
And raising their voices in hopes that the leaders from 21 Asia-Pacific economies will hear what they have to say.
Last year,
some in large numbers with loud voices.
Shut down APEC.
But in this case, a more personal protest in silence. There are people here to speak out about the climate, the Israel-Hamas war, the conflict in Myanmar between the military rulers and ethnic groups. Kokolay is demonstrating against all the leaders of the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation, or APEC.
They are selling arms to Burma, especially Russian, sell the arms. Also, second is China, and also Thailand, and including India.
Some people are protesting because the meeting between President Joe Biden and Chinese leader Xi Jinping is an opportunity to highlight their voices. Zheng Wei says the harsh COVID-19 measures in China was one of the reasons why he left China with his family.
I came from Los Angeles to San Francisco to stand with other pro-democracy activists.
San Francisco's mayor says the city supports the right of people to voice their opinions. Here's Mayor London Breed.
We want to make sure people know that we support peaceful protests. So any acts of violence or destruction of property will not be something that we would tolerate.
Security barriers have been set up with hundreds of extra law enforcement in town to ensure the safety of the world leaders as well as the activists. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News, San Francisco.
The World Food Program warns that deadly floods in Somalia are putting the livelihoods and lives of 4.3 million people in risk. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Somalia is a tragic poster child for climate change. The country is still recovering from the longest drought in its recorded history, which pushed the country to the brink of famine. Having barely averted that catastrophe, Somalia now must contend with floods that reportedly have killed more than 30 people, caused widespread destruction of infrastructure, and forced 500,000 people to seek safety on higher ground. World Food Program spokesperson in Somalia, Petra Quilton, says that number is increasing rapidly. Speaking from Nairobi, Kenya, he says he just came from a week in Beletwene on the Shabelle River, which is flooded.
Even before the floods came, you could see the human impact of this crisis. I passed dozens, hundreds of people on the roads fleeing from low ground, donkey carts, trucks, piled high with furniture, families perched on top. I've seen camps, internally displaced people, totally abandoned to rising flood water and waist-deep mud.
Wilton warns the climate shocks from drought to floods will prolong the hunger crisis in Somalia. He says 4.3 million people, a quarter of the population, will be facing crisis-level hunger by the end of the year. Moreover, he says a million children face acute malnutrition. He says it is difficult to predict the number of people who might die from this disaster. However, he notes 43,000 people were estimated to have died because of the drought last year.
The reason that's relevant is because many of those people were in crisis level hunger, IPC3. That's not the most extreme level of hunger, but what it tells us is that if you are stuck in crisis level hunger for long enough, you are still at risk of death. So that is very much what is at stake here.
Wilton says WFP was able to mitigate some of these impacts before the floods hit. He says the agency, working with the government, activated an anticipatory action plan to deliver cash transfers and warning messages to families about where the rains would be heaviest. The plan gave families advance information so they could protect themselves from the floods. It also gave them money to buy food at a time when their cupboards were bare. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The U.S. House has voted to prevent a government shutdown. The Senate is to act next, followed by President Biden, who must sign the bill before Friday's deadline to avoid a shutdown. Sagar Magani, the Washington correspondent for the Associated Press, reports.
New House Speaker Mike Johnson seems on track to avoiding his predecessor's fate as the House looks to avoid a federal shutdown. The last time Congress tried to avert one, it cost Kevin McCarthy his job. Johnson's not worried about his.
This is a different situation.
The House is set to vote on a funding package before Friday's shutdown deadline without any of the deep spending cuts House conservatives are demanding. Johnson may need help from Democrats to pass it.
We're not surrendering. We're fighting. But you have to be wise about choosing the fight.
This fight involves temporarily funding federal agencies in two batches. It's unique and, some say, bizarre.
Sort of goofy.
But Senate Democratic Chief Chuck Schumer says Johnson's taken the right approach by leaving out the hard right demands which Democrats would have rejected.
I'm heartened, very cautiously so.
And hopes the House approves the measure so the Senate can move fast. Sagar Magani, Washington.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone at VOA, thank you for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. Until next time, this is Rick Pantaleo in Washington, wishing you good day, good health, and good news tomorrow.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
During the recent meeting in Tokyo of the foreign ministers of the world's leading industrial democracies, known as the G7, discussions focused on current international crises and the need for a unified response. The discussions were fruitful, said U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken.
The G7 has strengthened its role as the steering committee of the world's advanced democracies, demonstrating unprecedented unity of purpose and unity of action on the issues that are defining the 21st century.
The first was the crisis in the Middle East, said Secretary Blinken.
The G7 ministers reaffirmed our staunch support for Israel's right and obligation to defend itself and seek to ensure the attacks of October 7th can never happen again in accordance with international humanitarian law.
The ministers also agreed, Secretary Blinken said, that humanitarian pauses would help to protect Palestinian civilians, increase the sustained flow of humanitarian assistance to allow our citizens and foreign nationals to exit, and to facilitate the release of hostages.
Ultimately, the only way to ensure that this crisis never happens again is to begin setting the conditions for durable peace and security. These must include the Palestinian people's voices and aspirations at the center of post-crisis governance in Gaza.
Another key focus of the meeting was the G7's enduring support for Ukraine.
The G7 has led the world in galvanizing and sustaining that support. And as we told Foreign Minister Kuleba today, Ukraine can count on us.
Secretary Blinken noted that the G7 ministers also discussed the Indo-Pacific and steps they are taking together to contend with challenges to their shared vision of a free, open, and prosperous region. Those challenges include the PRC's actions in the South and East China Seas and the PRC's coercive efforts to change the status quo on Taiwan. Discussions also focused on the DPRK's provocative actions and missile launches and the dangerous military cooperation between between the DPRK and Russia. At this inflection point in the struggle of protecting the international order, we are standing strong for our vision of a more free, secure, open, and prosperous world, declared Secretary Blinken. And we do not stand alone. We've built extraordinary coalitions with allies and partners who carry their share of the burden, and we leave this G7 meeting stronger and more united in meeting the challenges of today.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.